on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
God, I can't believe it.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Welcome to another edition of
Happiness to be found even in the darkest of times.
That system probably contains a new data encryption algorithm. You'll never get in there.
Welcome to The Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast, the show that talks all things mental health, emotional well-being, and what we can do to make us that little bit happier. Now, my guest today is a mental health advocate, campaigner, and writer. He knows firsthand what it's like to reach rock bottom, but equally what it feels like to come through the other side. His writing is explicit and it hits the reader hard. Exactly how it should be. In one recent article, he reminded us that 84 men die by suicide every week. Every 2 hours in the UK, a man takes his own life, affecting families, friends, and creating a ripple that will go on to devastate those who are left behind, leaving them weighed down with questions and heartache. My guest's writing holds up a mirror to society, to us all, asking us not to shy away from important conversations about our mental health, conversations that we avoid, believing that they are too difficult to have. But it is these avoided conversations that often come at a heavy price. Dare I say, we'll be having one of those conversations today. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Richard Taylor. Rich, how are you?
Thank you for that introduction, James. It's always nice to hear my writing read back to me a little bit. So I appreciate that. And it's really good to be here. I'm really thankful for the opportunity.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on. I know we've tried to get a date in the diary for a while. And as I said there in the top of the show, your writing is, well, it is, it packs a punch, but a punch that it needs to pack, because it's so explicit, and it hits home hard, and it's refreshing. For me personally, it's really refreshing. But before we take a sort of deeper dive into that, please share, Rich, sort of a little bit of your background and sort of your journey to date.
So I always, whenever I do interviews like this or talk about my story, I start in different points at different times. And I think on the basis of why we're here today to talk about general happiness, and I think I'd like to get the really horrible stuff out of the way. So my journey with mental illness starts with when I was diagnosed at 15. I was diagnosed with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and depression at the same time. And it was affecting my life at school, at home, friendships and personal relationships. But I think to just get to the crux of how it really can affect a person, between the ages of 18 and 20, I didn't go to university. I was too unwell. But I spent around 9 months completely bedbound with my OCD. Content warning to talk about sort of weight loss and obviously, I guess, trauma or some form of self-harm. But I wasn't eating. I dropped down to about 8 stone, and I looked skeletal. And I was living with a partner at the time in her home. And my dad was caring for his mum and dad. His dad was going through cancer. My dad was trying to hold down a job whilst also care for his adult son. And he was doing everything for me, helping me to bathe and eat and dress and wash. You know, it was a complete loss of dignity and self-respect for me, and all of the attributes that make us who we are. I sort of had nothing. And it got so, you know, traumatic for both of us, to the point where around 9 months in, I'd felt suicidal every day. And ironically, my OCD was the thing that stopped me taking my own life, because I was too scared to touch anything or move or do anything because of the fear that my OCD gave me. But my dad looked at me and broke down one day, and completely was in floods of tears and said, "I'm looking at my son and watching him die, and I can't do this anymore. And if you're going to go, then I'm going as well. So shall we go together?"
Wow.
And it was that moment that the floodlights came back on, that, you know, the generators kicked in again. And it was that metaphorical slap across the face that you see in films or read in books. And for me, I hadn't been awake or conscious or sort of almost sentient for so long. I hadn't been living. I was merely existing. I was just breathing. And that moment shook me starkly into life again, because I was killing not only myself, but I was killing my dad. And it was, I can never convey the emotions that myself and my dad have been through throughout our lives together. But that was, you know, when people talk about rock bottom, I think that's as low as you can get.
Mm.
And from there, you know, almost a decade later, I'm now in a healthy relationship, living on my own with my partner, my dad, and myself have got a really great relationship. You know, not to make it sound like I've got it easy, I still struggle every day with my OCD and depression. Some days are easier, some days are much, much harder. I still have struggles that last, you know, days, weeks, months. And there have been lots of ups and downs in between, but that's certainly the lowest I've ever been in my life, that time where I was hopeless and I didn't see a light at the end of the tunnel, and I stopped looking for it because I thought it was impossible.
Rich, how do you, when you reflect upon that period over those 9 months, how did you reach that stage? As you say, it's been 10 years now, best part of 10 years. And when you think back, how did it get there, and where did it all begin?
I think it almost sounds too easy and almost like a cop-out, but I drifted into that place, I think. What people tend to not realize about OCD is that you see the misrepresentation of it in media, whether that's films, books, TV, radio, as this condition or almost sort of quirk or trivial personality trait that doesn't have a great impact on your life. But when you live with it, it almost takes over who you are, to the point where you want that with you to protect you. Because in the beginning, OCD wants to protect you. It's this primordial, primeval fear response, and it's something that you don't realize is happening, especially when you don't know a lot about it yourself. And I think that was part of the problem. I had very little knowledge about the condition, and it was something that happened over many months and many years of bowing down to the illness, really, without consciously realizing. And I think that's how you get trapped in this position where you feel constricted and constrained by this voice in your head that is doing its very damnedest to convince you it's there to protect you and help you. And you know, I have spoken to counselors and friends and family members about, you know, events in my life that could have played a part. The classic is that my parents split up when I was about 7.5, and many people have tried to attribute it to that. And I think really it's so many different variables that pull together to create this symbiotic relationship between the person who lives with obsessive compulsive disorder and the person themselves. And I think that was the problem. I couldn't distinguish between the two. I became so wrapped up in it that, you know, I almost lost myself.
Mm. And did you, can you think back during that period of 9 months where you were completely bedridden, and were there any sort of conscious periods of thinking, this is not working for me, this is not right for me? Had it taken hold then and all become too much? You speak there, and having read the article, and we'll touch on that later, because there is a wonderfully written article, as I touched on in the introduction there, about how, you know, as you said there, that sort of moment with what your dad said to you, that brought you out, that kicked the generators in. In that 9 months of being bedridden, were you ever present and sort of thinking, this can't be right, this can't be what life is about?
I like to think that I was. In an ideal world, I like to think that I was trying to fight it somewhere and somehow in my brain. But the reality was that I was completely lost. I was completely overwhelmed by fear, and I remember parts of that time period. Some of it's a blur, but the only memories I have of that period are filled with fear. You know, not sort of the kind of fear that something's going to happen to you immediately and you're in physical danger, but this omnipresent, omnipotent fear that I need to follow the rules and do whatever my OCD tells me to do, and I'll be okay, and I'll stay alive, and the people I love will be okay. And I think that is the hardest aspect of OCD to convey to people that don't have it, or their only understanding of it is the misrepresentation that they've seen or heard or read. OCD preys on the things you love the most, and that's the double bluff, because by doing that you actually stop interacting with and taking part in healthy relationships with the people that you love and the things you like to do. And I think that's what's so difficult, is that I honestly only remember those periods of fear. And if there were ever times of trying to get out of that, it's very fleeting. And, you know, I think that's the hardest part. And obviously, it wasn't that people in my life at that time, and mainly my dad, were just happy to see me living like that or just settled on it. And in conversations I've had over the years since with my dad, he's spoken about, and not confessed to me, but, you know, admitted to me that he spoke to the police and ambulance services and doctors about how to get me out of that situation. And they said, well, we'd have to try and section me. They'd have to try and section me. Mm-hmm. And if I resisted, it would be a case of not arrest me, but sort of hold me and then put me into forced psychiatric units. And I remember at times in that period telling my dad that if anyone ever tried to get me out of that bed or take me out of that room, I would kill myself, because the fear that my OCD gave me or forced upon me was so great that suicide, you know, taking my own life was my only sort of viewpoint. And I think that is the thing that not necessarily scares me now, but upsets me the most, is that that was how I reacted to people who loved me trying to help me.
What was the support, if any, at that time? You said their dad reached out to local police and the ambulance service. What were the other sort of professional support networks at that time?
I think this is something that I necessarily can't comment on, but I genuinely don't know enough, because now with a decade on and the years and years of campaign work that I've got behind me and advocacy work and experience within the mental health and mental illness sphere, I now know the services that could have been contacted. But, you know, I think it's easy to forget, really, that 10 years ago, it was a much different place, and the services weren't as understanding or weren't as accepting or weren't as effective as they are today. And they still aren't that effective now. And I don't know what was available at the time. I remember that my dad, when speaking to the GP, just got told, and again, this is conversations we've had since, that the only way to help me would be to take me out of that setting. And that they reiterated that to get me out of that setting without my cooperation would be to section me and then provide the help at that point. And I can't imagine what it must have been like for my dad. I mean, I can imagine it, and it's so painful and so difficult. But then I also don't have a child, so I can't imagine what he must have been going through. Mm. As I said at the start, you know, he was looking at his only child wasting away. You know, it's not saying it lightly that I was dying. If it carried on the way it did, I would have died, whether that was by suicide or how I was living. And thinking about that too much and what could have been is not a place I like to go in my mind very often.
No. And I do appreciate you sharing it in the way that you are and you have done in your writing. If I may, Rich, what was life like up until 15? You know, you mentioned there obviously parents separating, but what was life like during secondary school for you, primary school?
I had a not sort of like a remarkable childhood. I wasn't a sports star, or, you know, I didn't do anything fantastic in the community, or I had a really average, great life in suburban London. It was, you know, I remember going and playing with friends over the park. I had a great park over the road. I was very fortunate that in school I could blend into the social groups that existed. I wasn't fixed with one. And I had a very average life. I was very happy at home. I never ever wanted for anything or needed for anything. I was, you know, by all accounts, had a very privileged life, and I had family that loved me and cared for me. I was a good student. I was terrible with homework, but in exams and at school, I was very studious and what would be classed as a teacher's pet, probably. I always put my hand up first and that kind of thing. But, you know, there were never any signs for me, really. It was never something that I look back now and think, oh, well, maybe because of this or maybe because of that, I was like I was. And I think part of the problem you get into when you're someone in my position that has been very unwell early on in life, you know, it's something that you try and find answers to. And I think that's a trap that you can fall into whereby there might not always be those answers. Or if there are, you might not necessarily find them right now. And accepting that and understanding that and appreciating that that's my situation at the moment is something that took a long time to get to. Acceptance, and we can talk about this later on in the show, but acceptance for me has been a huge part of being able to cope and not only cope and live, but to sort of thrive after those experiences.
Mm. Well, I think that, you know, acceptance and appreciating are undervalued or you know, perhaps processes that are often overlooked. And I suppose from a OCD perspective, the sheer existence is a hard analysis, a constant hard analysis of right or wrong. Built yeah. or based upon a felt sense, and if society encourages someone in recovery or experiencing OCD to then apply a sort of hard investigation to the whys, it certainly runs the risk of fueling that OCD further.
Yeah, and I think that's the big thing is that. OCD thrives and lives and devours uncertainty. That's what it lives on. And when you go back into times of uncertainty to question it and try and gain a definitive answer, knowing that you possibly can't and knowing that that is a very likely probability, that is, like you say, when you run the risk of the OCD kicking in and saying, well, why? What can we do? How can we put some structure and rigidity in place that will give you some form of coping mechanism to be able to deal with this uncertainty? And I still struggle with that. You know, I'm a very, very talkative person about what's going on in my brain and my emotions and how I feel. And I love trying to figure things out, whether that's things to do with myself or other people. But I also know that that isn't necessarily the best way to approach problems and that not all problems have a solution and or can be solved. And I think that in and of itself is something I've had to accept over time as well. And you know, anyone who is listening that has OCD will be able to relate, and especially if you're caught in the midst of a period of time where it's, you know, severely affecting you, it is almost the only way to break free is to stop seeking uncertainty. And I know, as cliche as that sounds, it is such an easy thing to say. And an almost impossible thing to do when it's got a grip of you.
Very much so. And I suppose the challenge for us all is that the one predictable or certain outcome in life is that life will always be unpredictable and uncertain.
Yeah.
How did it impact the social, you know, you said there, secondary school, you know, by and large, textbook existence, you know, moved between social groups freely and was happy in school. At that point in your life, when at 15 being diagnosed with OCD and depression, what were the implications and how did it affect your relationships? And were your friends and social group aware of what you was going through?
It didn't really have any short-term implications. And I think I'm not particularly sure why. I've not really tried to figure out why. Certainly with social groups it didn't. But, I mean, it affected me at school because it was right around the time of my GCSEs. And I remember I was very fortunate with my secondary school that they were really understanding and accepting of it and helpful. And I, you know, I'm very fortunate that was the case. And I was able to get through my GCSEs and I achieved grades that I didn't think were possible given how unwell I had been in and around that time period. It didn't really affect my social life until I was about 17 or 18 years old because when I went to sixth form, I was, you know, from an outside perspective, almost recovered. You know, you wouldn't have ever guessed or been able to tell that I had OCD and depression. I was voted as head boy of sixth form. I was one of the first in my sixth form to drive a car. You know, jokingly, if I'm ever passing my old sixth form, I look on it as my old kingdom because it did feel like, you know, the place where I had the most control of my life and was genuinely really happy. But then I got, right, again, whether it's stress or I'm not sure of exams or stressful periods of life, right around the time, you know, in the 6 months leading up to my final A-level exams, I contracted chickenpox. And I had been told and vaguely remember having it as a child. And I believed the myth that if you've got it as a kid, you can't get it as an adult.
Yeah.
But whatever happened, I contracted chickenpox. I was hospitalized and then was again bedbound for a week or two, wrapped up like a mummy with bandages because it became infected. And I had to have all like tests done and my OCD brain kicked in and said, well, you got that from being at sixth form, so you can't go back. And that had an immediate effect on my social life, my ability to perform at school, my ability to take part in events outside of school, socially, academically, all of the above. And again, was very, very fortunate that the school were understanding and put measures in place to allow me to take my A-levels. And I can't thank both places of education that I went to enough. But that's when the downturn started that led to those 9 months being bedbound and suicidal every day was that period of time. And I very quickly cut off friends. I took myself off Facebook and social media and lost friends because, you know, how do I tell them that because of this thing in my brain that I didn't even talk about within myself or acknowledge was stopping me living life and going to restaurants with them or going to the cinema or going bowling or going to the park. And I didn't know how to process it myself. So I just withdrew completely into myself. You know, I closed everyone off. And it's something that, you know, I've had conversations with friends, best friends that I was with at the time, you know, 8-9 years later, where only then have we talked about why I sort of dropped off the radar and what happened to me. And I hear it from their perspective that they had no clue, you know, they had no idea what was going on, only that their friend was there one day and wasn't the next and wasn't able to speak to them. And I think that's something that hurts the most, if there's one or a couple of things, is that the, you know, OCD robs you of your time, your life, your friendships, your ability to engage with the world, have fun, to work, to form relationships, to eat, to sleep. You know, it plays havoc with existence. And as humans, we're hardwired to exist socially and connect and communicate. And I think knowing how important that aspect of my life is to me now, that hurts, knowing that I look back and lost those friendships because of it.
What was it, Rich, or why was it that you couldn't communicate what you were feeling at that time?
I think probably the fact that I didn't really know what was going on. And I've been able to communicate it now because I've got a very good understanding of what OCD was doing to me at the time, how OCD works, and just a confidence to own it, to, you know, to just front up and say, well, I was really unwell. But when you're that age and, you know, in your late teens and you've built that rapport and friendship, you know, I was really outgoing. I was a lead guitarist in a rock band and we played festivals and gigs. And to suddenly admit or accept or acknowledge that you're not well and that you can't do those things and you can't give a reason why, that was really difficult. Because, you know, not only those friendships at the time, but, you know, I was very lucky with my dad. We used to go on holiday to the same sort of resort every year in Menorca, and I made friendships for life there. And suddenly being on holiday was difficult as well, and I couldn't, you know, it really affected all of every aspect of my life, and I couldn't, you know, understand that, and how could I tell anyone something that I don't understand? It was so difficult.
And it sounds as though it was reaching a point where there was this almost split between what you were projecting on the outside and trying to maintain the relationships or a facade, but what you were actually feeling internally, until it reaches a point where you just can't do it anymore.
Yeah. I think that's part of the OCD as well, is that it's sometimes classed as the secret illness or the hidden illness. And it carries so much shame and embarrassment. And you know, I hear people with OCD that say they're frightened of being caught carrying out a compulsion or behavior with their OCD. And that makes me so upset and sad and angry and confused and frustrated, because if someone had a broken leg and was struggling to get on and off the train or up some stairs, you wouldn't laugh at them or joke about it or trivialize it. You'd help them. But when someone is going through an OCD ritual or behavior or compulsion, it's almost like we look on that and go, oh, that's odd, that's weird, I wouldn't want to be like that. And I appreciate that it's hard to relate to something you can't see. And I appreciate that, you know, unless you've experienced OCD, it's very difficult to convey what that's like, similarly to a lot of mental illness problems. But I think I was just trying to hold on to the brief parts of life and happiness that I had, and if by pretending that everything was fine was a way to do that, then I was gonna do it. And I think that's the problem, is that you don't want to confront it.
Hmm. You mentioned something earlier, and I think it's quite timely to bring this in now, about the misconceptions around OCD and wider sort of mental health and mental illness conversations. And, you know, I think that, you touch on there that the OCD, you mentioned that, or you say OCD, and most people will have heard of obsessive compulsive disorder. But I worry that it's almost been brought into popular conversation and diluted in terms of its magnitude and the severity and the aggression that it can have and the debilitating effects it can have over somebody's life. Is that something that you've found, agree with? And this is a double question, apologies, but, you know, share what you was experiencing and what your OCD looked like and the specifics and how it become so difficult for you each day.
So that's something that I could spend a long time doing. So I'll briefly talk about what I experience. I think I have to start with what OCD actually is. And you know, OCD is synonymous at the minute with perfectionism and neatness and tidiness and being just so. And that's completely wrong. But what's difficult is that some people's OCD presents itself in that way. But that isn't the initial point of OCD. The point of OCD are the thoughts and the, not just thoughts, because we all have them and we can't stop them. They're just intrinsically part of being human. But it's the intrusive thoughts that we all have. Everyone has them, whether you have OCD or not. But the difference is people with OCD fixate on them and obsess over them to the point where it changes their behavior and makes them carry out compulsions, whether physical or mental, to stop those thoughts. And, you know, a very common one that people, you know, kind of have an understanding of is, by and large, we've all, you know, been driving along or been stood at the platform at a train station and thought, I could just jump in front of the train. Or I could push someone in front of a train, or I could crash my car. And they're so fleeting that they come and then they, you know, people that don't have OCD go, oh, that was silly, and it goes away and it's gone. Whereas the person with OCD might fixate on that and obsess over that and ruminate on that and keep that playing over on loop in their head to the point where they say, right, well, if I don't do X, Y, or Z, then that's going to happen. So I'll do that. And then that just feeds the OCD and makes you want to keep doing that. So anytime you get those thoughts again, you do the compulsions and the behaviors. And I think that is the distinction between people wanting things neat and tidy or color coordinated or size coordinated because it makes them feel good and it looks nice, to people that do that because they think their family might die if they don't, or that they might burn their house down if they don't, or that they might harm themselves or someone else. And I think that's the difference. If you go out and you think, oh, did I leave the oven on? Does that stop you living your life that day? Or can you carry on and just check when you get home? And I think that's the distinction. And for me, it looks, you know, you talked about the very nature of life being unpredictable and uncertain. And I think that's what my OCD struggles with the most, is because nothing is predictable for me. And that fills me with constant fear. And you know, just some parts of my OCD or what it might look like is that, you know, if we're walking along the street and there is spit or chewing gum on the floor, if I step on that, previously I have had to throw shoes away. And it doesn't matter how much they cost, to the point where I tend not to buy new shoes. And if I do, I go to like Shoe Zone where they're £5 for a pair, because I know that there might be a time where I have to throw them away. It could be things like, you know, living at home right now, if I put something in the bin in the kitchen, I'll go and wash my hands. But then if I'm washing my hands and water splashes from the sink onto my body, I'll change my clothes and have a shower. Or if we're getting, you know, shopping coming in, I'll wipe down the shopping and put it away so that I don't have to wash my hands after every time I touch the shopping. You know, it's things that are almost imperceptible to someone who doesn't have OCD that you wouldn't notice I'm doing it. You know, for example, if I'm, you know, this obviously doesn't happen a lot under the current circumstances, but if I'm out having a drink in a pub, for example, I will constantly be vigilant about where the person serving the drinks has put their hands on my glass so that I don't drink from anywhere they might have touched. Or, and if they, very rarely, but if they've touched it by the top of the glass, I won't drink it and I'll ask for a new pint or you know, whatever. And it's those hundreds, maybe thousands of imperceptible changes in my behavior because of OCD that go unnoticed that make it so difficult to try and explain to people, because it's constant. It's not only present when something happens. It's always present to make sure something doesn't happen. And I think that's the difference between someone that has OCD and is diagnosed and struggles with the illness, and someone that has a tendency or a personality to like things neat or coordinated or in order.
Yeah, well, I think you summarise and distinguish it extremely well. For me, you know, the reputation has come how society has, you know, diluted it down and softened it around the edges, but because each and every one of us, as human beings, will enjoy routine, will enjoy a groove to fit into and allow things to play out. But it's those behaviours that are having a significant impact that takes it up several notches, as you quite rightly say, that then changes the direction of travel for the individual. For the individual that is experiencing this increase in level of discomfort, and something that's, you know, that has laced and weaved throughout the conversation already is that fear element, that fear that presents. And you know, I've never heard someone say this before. And again, you know, as I touched on at the beginning, your writing is potent and so strong, but you speak so well as also, Rich, and you said there that, you know, that OCD preys on the things that you love the most, and you know, and that's that impact, that solid impact that it has on a day-to-day basis, and crippling and debilitating for those that are experiencing it.
Yeah, I think just to touch on that as well, and something that's fortunately come into the fore, you know, in recent years, and not just with OCD, but, you know, with postnatal depression, and you know, thankfully, there was the storyline in EastEnders that was about, I think it was like psychosis with a new parent. But when you look at people that develop OCD after having children, and the heavy focus is on mothers, but this affects fathers, you know, just as much. It is that thing of your baby, your, you know, and again, I haven't got children, but by all accounts, everything we hear is that it's this newfound love that you can't comprehend that you have that overwhelms you. And OCD will prey on that. And OCD, I've got friends that they're OCD focused around their new child, and that they wrongly convince themselves that they'd harmed their child to the point where they've taken themselves to the police and said, I've done this, and they haven't. And I think there's this horrible sort of reputation that OCD has, that, you know, oh, so we focus about harm, and we might be dangerous, or we might be harmful. And it's so far from the truth, because the very nature of OCD is that because we're terrified that our brains make us think we're going to do harm to either ourselves or others, we go to extraordinary lengths to not create a situation where that harm could happen, even though we know that isn't us, it's our brain. And I think that's such an important part to get across, is the distinction between being diagnosed and having the illness, or being someone that likes things neat or tidy, is, like you say, that fear, that completely staggering, overwhelming, all-consuming fear. And if you're not driven by that, you've probably not got OCD. You probably just like things tidy and neat.
I think that I'm in awe of just listening to you speak, Rich. I think that, you know, it's such a journey that you've been on, and one that, you know, when you felt that intense level of fear, to come back from that, you know, shows the type of individual that you are. I think we should go to your first song, and when we come back, talk about that road to recovery, you know, from that point, that conversation with Dad, what that looked like, and what were the sort of timelines.
Okay.
Stick with us here on the Happiness Algorithm. I'm James Roast. I'm joined by Rich Taylor. This is his first song choice.
Thank you.
Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast. I'm joined by Rich Taylor, and that was his first song choice. That was Glenn Miller, In the Mood. And whilst that were playing, I confess to Rich that I'm actually a secret Glenn Miller fan. Love Glenn Miller, Rich.
Yeah, it's that song just takes me to a distinct physical place and a moment in time when I first heard it. And it just fills me with happiness. And my nan, who I, you know, was such a big part of my life and you know, so special to me. She loved Glenn Miller as well. She was obviously of that generation. And I'm very fortunate that I've got a very diverse music taste.
Yeah, well, I know the listeners are going to curse me for this because I pretty much say it every week, but it's so important. Music is so important, and it takes us off in many different journeys and different directions. And I think the eclectic mix of music and hearing guest choices on the show is one that I just think is just wonderful. And you know, when you said Glenn Miller, I thought, oh, lovely. Yeah, we'll get some get some Glenn Miller on, definitely. So, Rich, obviously, you know, before we took that break, we spent some time discussing sort of your journey and OCD and how sort of crippling and debilitating it was. And, you know, you really sort of articulated extremely well what you had been through. And, you know, to use some of your words, that, you know, it OCD thrives and devours everything that we love and sort of care for and deem to be important. I think for me, the distinguishing factors, as we said also before the break, is the impact that it's having on our life, how we measure the significance of those behaviors and really how it kind of it plagues the psyche and our emotional well-being by devouring those things that we love and are important, and how our brain tries to it grasps and gets our attention because of that internal struggle.
Yeah, definitely.
And it did take you on a very, very dangerous journey for a long period of time, for quite a significant part of your life as well. But then there was that conversation with Dad, those really powerful words that your dad used. And then again, sorry, just to use what you've said, but the generators kicked in and the lights came on. What then happened then?
A very long story short, my mum's side of the family live in Blackpool up in the Northwest, and I wrongly at the time believed that my OCD was as bad as it was because of where I was living and experiences I'd had in my childhood. So I sort of, you know, said to myself, well, if I move away, you know, it's the classic running away from your problems. But I was, you know, it was a desperate and sort of, you know, torrid time and, that's the solution I came up with. If I move away, I'll get better. And no doubt that had I not moved away and moved up to Blackpool to live with my aunt and uncle, I would have died, I reckon. If I hadn't moved away, I would have either died or I would have been in a psychiatric hospital and sectioned and then who knows. But I moved up to Blackpool and I'll never forget it because it was the opening day or the day of the opening ceremony of the London Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. And I'd been with my partner for, I think, nearly 3 years at the time, and I was leaving everything. You know, I remember and my nan had helped to, like, raise me and, you know, bring me up, and I'd said goodbye to her thinking I'll never see her again. And I said goodbye to my partner knowing that we were only splitting up because of my OCD. We still loved each other, but we, you know, we were in floods of tears in the morning. And then I remember getting on a train with my dad and we went up to Blackpool, and we were the only people going, you know, out of London when you were on our own the whole way. And it was crazy. I remember, you know, taking nothing with me, thinking that I had to shed, you know, physically every aspect of who I was and what I was from, you know, home to be able to start this new life in Blackpool. And I remember walking from the hotel where my dad was staying to my aunt and uncle's, and there's a bridge at Blackpool Airport. Well, it's not the airport anymore, I don't think, but there's a bridge there, and I was walking over that saying goodbye to my dad, thinking I would never see him again. You know, genuinely, it was a situation where we thought the only way to save me was to never see each other again. And I was crying my eyes out, and I, you know, at the corner of my aunt and uncle's road, I took my shoes off because I couldn't bear the thought of carrying the association of my life on the soles of my shoes into the house of my aunt and uncle. And I remember when I got to my aunt and uncle's, I took all my clothes off and stood naked at the age of like 20 and put all of the clothes in a carrier bag that my aunt had, and she put them in the bin, and I showered, and it was almost like, okay, this is my new life, you know. And from there, it was a very strange time, and I went to college, and still, you know, my OCD followed me and was still there, but I went to college and made new friends and formed new relationships and got a bit of life back and moved into a flat, and then it catches up with you, and you know, running away only gets you so far, and you know, fairly quickly after a few years of progress, my OCD took me into decline again, and I was, you know, to the point, and this is something that I haven't really spoken about. I'm not sure if I have actually mentioned this publicly as such anywhere, and I'm happy to do so because it, you know, I've spoken to my dad about it, and he said we should carry no shame about the things that OCD makes me do and makes me think. But I remember I was in Blackpool, and I couldn't leave the flat to get any food for myself. And, you know, online shopping at the time wasn't an option for me because I couldn't conceive how I would, you know, bring everything in. Or so my dad, you know, at the age of, I mean, how, when was this? At the age of like 60, was driving from Kent up to Blackpool and dropping shopping off for me and then driving home. And was doing that twice a week for a period of time. And, you know, people hearing this might think, how ridiculous. You know, I lived above an Aldi and opposite from a Marks and Spencer and 10 minutes drive from a huge 24-hour Tesco. But my OCD was so severe that I couldn't leave the flat to shop or do anything. And I think unless you've been in that position as a person suffering or as a family member or loved one of someone that has OCD, you will never understand the lengths that you sometimes go to try and be there for them. And I think they're the things that hurt me the most, because even though through, you know, many sessions of counseling and talking with my dad and friends and family that have done things for me, even though I know they don't blame me or, you know, carry any sort of feelings of upset or frustration at me, that weight of guilt and shame and embarrassment is something that's like a little anchor on my leg, just constantly reminding me that my OCD has negatively affected people in my life so detrimentally that it has changed their lives. I think that's hard to take.
Has that lessened at all over the years, Rich, as you said before about sort of acceptance and, well, we'll stick with acceptance. Has it lessened, or is that still quite ripe, that feeling?
I think it comes and goes, you know. It's in recent sessions of therapy, I've been talking a lot about distress intolerance, and a massive part of, you know, my OCD that's an aggravating factor is feelings of emotional turmoil and distress. So the very nature of how my OCD makes me feel feeds my OCD. And it's almost like unlearning that process, unlearning those feelings is a massive part of the puzzle to help me. And I think that, you know, that question of how do I feel about it now, I have to answer honestly, and it changes. You know, there are some moments where I can be really accepting of myself and know that, you know, deep down it's not my fault. You know, like I'm not consciously trying to make people I love sad or upset or hurt or frustrated or annoyed. But then other times I feel it really acutely. You know, I'll take, for example, yesterday my partner and I were going to go for a walk round at where we live to a really nice green area and reservoir. And on the way, because with my OCD, I'm constantly looking at the floor and where I'm walking for spit or chewing gum or you know, dog poo or, you know, whatever. She stepped in spit and I said, you know, almost immediately, because my OCD just fires my brain into action, oh, well, when we get back after the walk, I'm just going to like spray the bottom of our shoes with disinfectant. And that immediately caused like a rift between me and my partner, because she rightly gets frustrated and upset that, you know, one nice thing that we want to try and do and my OCD is there and it never goes away. And, you know, it's that process of constantly evaluating and constantly looking for and problem solving issues that aren't there. You know, I know that this driver for my OCD is irrational and illogical and makes no sense. And I think I would rather not know that. It's harder knowing that and being aware that it's irrational. I think that's the best description I can give it. Sometimes I feel it really acutely, and sometimes I can, you know, ride the wave and you know, be part of that process.
And what has enabled you to get to that point, Rich? You've mentioned there about counselling. Has that allowed you to get a better understanding of what you've been through to then inform decisions and how you react to situations? You touched there on sort of distress tolerance. What has been your, you know, where did you move? Well, I suppose I don't want to jump ahead too far, actually, because obviously with the sort of second period of distress when you're stuck in your flat, off the back of the initial change and moving up to Blackpool, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. But if I may, if we can jump backwards and forwards, what is it that's got you to this stage now to get a better understanding of your OCD?
I think there's only so much you can do by understanding something. You know, it's great and helps me when I'm well enough to apply that knowledge. But a lot of the time when you're in the grip of for lack of a better term, like an OCD episode or, you know, all of that flies out the window, you know, and you're just going by your lizard brain and, you know, it's not operating on a level of rationale. And I think part of what's helped me is this radical honesty and openness and, you know, someone that I really admire and would encourage anyone that feels shame and you know, has shame play a negative part of your life would be to listen to Brené Brown and to talk about vulnerability and shame and listen to her TED Talks, because just, you know, accepting that this is something that's happened to me. And by doing that, so many other conversations with people have highlighted that this actually happens to thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of people around the world. And like I'm sure has been discussed on this show and others similar, we always feel like we're alone. We always feel like we're the only person in the world that feels like this and has these thoughts.
Mm.
And they might take different shapes and forms and have different outcomes, but everyone along a spectrum of severity will have these thoughts. And not to confuse that spectrum with whether you have OCD lightly or severely, because just like with cancer or heart disease, you have it or you don't. But, you know, that's something that I have depended upon is that knowing that other people experience what I'm experiencing, and falling back on that is a lovely trampoline to land on when I'm feeling unsteady.
Mm. Well, I think that there is the statement for me is that radical honesty. And, you know, I think we could all learn to be a little bit more transparent and honest, firstly with ourselves, but then enabling us to communicate with others. And if we contrast that back to, you know, adolescent Rich, and as you said before, in the rock band and, you know, going from living in the prime of your life, but this almost behind the scenes, struggling with this OCD and not having the words or vocabulary or the confidence or the fear being too great to then effectively communicate that, to be radically honest with self. I think that's a fantastic relationship of words there, that radical honesty. So going back to your period after college, you know, incredible to go from being bedbound, the conversation with dad, and then is that in the right order, and then moving up to Blackpool and enrolling in college, cultivating new relationships. I mean, it sounds as though life was good, you know, in a period of relative stability. What all of us can hope for is relative stability, as it were. But then it seems to ghost in again. That OCD, as you said before, it drifted. You drifted into that place, and again, slowly, it returned. Do you remember that period more explicitly the second time, because you'd been through it once? And what did that feel like?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate that second period was nowhere near as bleak as the first, and could have easily been, but wasn't. And I think having been through it before helped, but I certainly remember a lot more of how I coped. And you know, again, being honest, a lot of what I did to cope was to drink. I used to go out 4 or 5 nights a week, and Blackpool is a very, very fun place to go out, and it's very, very cheap. especially if you've lived in and around London all of your life, to then, you know, I used to go out on a Monday night, and in Blackpool, I don't know what it's like now, but they had this thing called Monday Madness, and all night across town, wherever you went for a drink, you could get a mixer and a spirit for £1, and you could get a double for £1.50. And I just used to get very, 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 very drunk, because it completely took me away from having to cope with how I felt. And by no means am I advocating this. This was, you know, some people, you know, term it as, you know, a form of self-harm in a way. Yeah. And I guess it was indirect self-harm, because I just was doing anything to cope. And I remember nights where I would come home and call my dad and be on the phone because I couldn't get in the shower. And that's not physically that I couldn't, but I was so scared, because if I got in the shower, I don't know when I'd be able to get out, because would it ever be enough to make me feel clean? And there's one particular moment. I can't remember the date, but I had a blog at the time where I wrote about how I was feeling, and this entry was written at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was just sitting in the spare room on the floor in and amongst a pile of dirty laundry, crying my eyes out and feeling like I wanted to take my own life, because I knew that if I got in the shower, I'd be in there for hours and hours until I felt like I could get out and be clean. And I was terrified, because I thought, well, how can this be my life? How can I have been here years ago and I'm back here again almost? And it was those moments, and I think, having been through it before, I could recognize that was how it was going again. And I guess, you know, assuming this is a question you were going to ask and answering it in advance, what pulled me out of that was another big life event, and that was that my nan was taken into hospital one night on a Tuesday in March in 2016. So I drove down from my flat because Dad said, you know, you need to come and say goodbye. And it was like 10 o'clock at night when I left, and I remember being, I'd never driven through London, and usually I'd go around the M25, but it was closed, and so I had to drive through the city, and I got stuck in a council estate in Camden at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the next day we spent all day in the hospital with my nan, and she passed away that day, and I got to say goodbye, and then I never went back to the flat. I just stayed with Dad, and again, that pulled me out of that scenario of being isolated, of being on my own, and something else was more important. You know, the love I had for my nan was more important, or took over, or overpowered that fear. And if anything, that gives me hope that love, in my instance, really is stronger than fear.
So it's connecting with the relationships or the individuals that enrich our life, that as you say, it outweighs or it conquers that fear element.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I say the irony, over the past week, so I read this book called Hello World, and it's all about algorithms and how they affect our world. And last night, my partner and I watched The Social Dilemma on Netflix, And that's all about, you know, how social networks and you know, these means of communication, although, you know, often and sometimes positive, have a very negative effect on our lives globally as well. And the fact that this is called the happiness algorithm, if, you know, if there was anything I was going to feed into like a binary code of how we could code happiness, would be love and connection with our loved ones. And, you know, that has certainly saved my life on many occasions.
Mm. Well, it is, you know, you alluded to it earlier, the fact that we are social creatures, and what underpins our existence is relationship. And but when we are in crisis, it does expose our vulnerability and heighten our state of isolation, and does encourage us to feel as though that we are the only people on the planet. And, you know, to then employ that radical honesty should and will, actually will, enable us to connect with others, primarily with self. So we're understanding, we're acknowledging, we're accepting what we're going through, and then looking to try and convey that vulnerability and fragility to significant others that do offer value and love and compassion and care in our life, that doesn't, I suppose, we don't live in this sort of dichotomous existence of black and white. It's always going to be varying shades of grey. But so it doesn't, you know, when we're reaching out, it doesn't take that pain, that fear away necessarily, but at least I know that I'm not on my own.
Yeah. You know, I often think about things my nan used to say, and two things, you know, things she always used to say that I carry with me in my life now and are just as important to me as they were to her and my dad, and is the first was that she always said a problem shared is a problem halved. And that's so true, because the problem doesn't go away, but you're not on your own with dealing with it anymore. And you have that double relief of support from someone else, but also getting it off your chest. And, you know, that's something I'm sure is said a lot here and elsewhere, and certainly is true for me. And the second thing, and I'm a very tactile person, and, you know, I've done all of the, you know, what's your love language, sort of all that stuff, and mine is always physical touch. And my nan always used to say to me, any time is cuddle time. And it sounds so silly and so childlike, but it's so true for me anyway, that a grounding, calming technique for me is to have physical connection with a loved one, or some form of physical sensation that brings me peace and calm. And, you know, it doesn't get rid of what's going on, but it certainly helps to, you know, give me a better footing to stand up to it and face the challenge.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think I remember reading a study once that said that when we embrace someone, when we cuddle them, hold them for 8 seconds, just sort of optimum, because it then at that point starts to release endorphins, and you know, you begin to relax. Because it's all very rushed. We live in a society that's, you know, a million miles an hour. But I'm with you. I'm with Nanny Taylor in the sense that, you know, any time is cuddle time. And I think if we can hold it for that little bit longer, you know, we will, you know, get out of it what we so deserve.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Rich, I am so engrossed in the conversation. I said off air I would, you know, time would get away with us, but we must play your second song.
Okay.
So stick with us here on the Happiness Algorithm. I'm joined today by Richard Taylor. We're talking all things sort of OCD, mental health, mental illness, emotional well-being, and what we can do to make us happy. And this is Rich's second song choice.
Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Rose. My special guest today is Rich Taylor, and that was his second song choice. That was Hall and Oates, You Make My Dreams Come True. Another great song there, Rich. Tell us the choice behind that.
Yeah, that's just something immediately makes me happy. The beginning of the song, and it's just such a song that gives me joy, not just happiness, but joy. It takes me out of my brain, out of my head, and just puts a smile on my face. And I can't explain it. And I think that's reason enough that I chose it. And I hope that it put a smile on some people's faces.
I think it is reason enough. And, you know, it's one of those songs that I think everyone knows, you know, it's one of those songs that you hear and it does just bring you a little bit of joy and it just lifts your mood. So I'm sure it will have done that. And thank you for choosing it.
That's great. You know, like you say earlier, music plays such an important part of our lives, and we don't often realize how important. And I think, you know, rightly, we can spend a lot of time analyzing and trying to understand things. But there are some things in life, like that song, that why do we have to understand? If it makes us feel happy, that's good enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Well said. So, Rich, we have, you know what, I feel almost, I can't believe how much time we've covered. And I feel like we've just touched the tip of the iceberg. I'm hoping that listeners are feeling it as deeply as I am listening to it and listening to you speak, because it is a hell of a journey that you've been on. And obviously you've touched on there, like this week popping out with your partner and are still working on that. You're still, the relationship with OCD is still there, and it ebbs and it flows, and it's more aggressive some days, and other days it's quieter. What is that like for you, and what's the sort of ongoing treatment path, or how do you see the next sort of 5 years with it? Do you ever feel that it will leave you at some point and you'll never worry about where you're walking or what you're walking on?
My overall goal is that I can do the things I want to do when I want to do them. And I accept and acknowledge that OCD might still be present and might still chime in and try and stop me, but that I will be able to make a decision for me and not because of my OCD telling me to do something. I don't try and think about any kind of treatment cure or that it will go away forever. You know, part of it for me is accepting that. And there are people that I, you know, I really care about in the sort of OCD community who talk about being 100% recovered. And I don't think, you know, that I genuinely don't think that exists. But I do believe very strongly that you can live your life completely how you want it to be with OCD present. You know, I think there are so many different tools and methods of therapy, whether that's CBT, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, or ERP, which is exposure response prevention therapy. You know, that's the biggest one for OCD, where, you know, to put it in simple terms, if you're scared of a spider, you hold the spider until you're not scared of it. So you do the thing that OCD makes you scared of until the OCD isn't as loud anymore. And, you know, a big one for me at the moment is ACT, you know, acceptance commitment therapy. And for me, I just, you know, I want to be able to live my life with my partner and family and friends where I and we do things that we want to do because we want to do them, and it doesn't stop me. And
I accept that that's not always going to be the case. I accept that some days I'm going to win, some days I'm not going to have the strength to fight it, and that's fine. You know, I'm not going to be able to do that every single time, and that's okay. And that's a level that I'm happy to accept, because if I try and think, well, I have to get rid of it, I have to beat it every time, that's not going to work. And I'll just set myself up for failure and disappointment. And that's not easy. It's not, you know, it's not like I'm able to just say that, you know, because I've decided that, you know, this is a decade and a half of my life that has given me the tools gradually to get to this point. But for me, that's what it looks like. That's the prognosis. And whether that's different kinds of therapy, you know, I'm never going to say no to anything. If someone wants to offer me help or suggest a way to for me to help myself, I'll look into it. I'll research it. I'll go away and I'll try it. Because when you've been in the depths of, you know, depression and OCD, and if you are mentally unwell and you're struggling, you are desperate and will try anything. And, you know, the last 6 months or so have been really bad for me. And part of that has been because of the global pandemic and the global situation we find ourselves in. And that has exacerbated my OCD. But part of that also is me knowing that I had a big life change. You know, I moved in with my partner at the start of the year, and, you know, that's a massive stressor. That's one of, you know, in general, one of the most stressful things you can do in life is move. And, you know, it does sound like such a cop-out, but just accepting all of these things that are happening and knowing that I don't necessarily have to do something to change it, that's what I'm leaning on right now.
Well, I think it's a good or the best approach and philosophy to embrace, because of the uncertainty. And as we said earlier in the show, that I suppose what the OCD craves is that certainty, and it craves that black and white. But inevitably, we're always going to fail, because the world's never going to be black and white. It's always going to be those shades of grey. And so that acceptance and that fluid motion backwards and forwards is something that comes with, as you say, maturation, experience, and acknowledgement.
Yeah. And you know, nothing is predictable. Nothing is, you know, something that we can account for. So it's just a case of dealing with it as and when we can, and how we have to.
For those that are listening that maybe are struggling themselves, or are listening and know of somebody that is struggling, what would be your recommendations, and where would you signpost them?
So I think if someone is struggling with OCD, I would certainly point, if you're struggling yourself, or if you're someone who cares for someone or loves someone that has OCD, please go to OCD Action. Their website, and they have a helpline as well, and an email support network. I've worked with them voluntarily for, you know, over the course of the last 4 years. I was the chair of the youth advisory panel for 3 years, and it's, you know, something that I'm very passionate about. I'm really conscious that they offer, you know, practical support. But then if it's a case that you're worried about, you know, your immediate well-being, and you are feeling suicidal, first, you know, reach out and have that conversation if you can. You know, part of destigmatizing the conversation around suicide is, you know, talking about it and saying the word. So there are Samaritans. I think the number is 116123 in the UK. And if you're a guy and you're worried about feeling suicidal, please go and talk to Calm. They mm-hmm. are specifically there for men experiencing feelings of suicide, and they are a suicide prevention charity for men. And they will be able to listen to you and help and just take on board what's going on for you. And then obviously, even though it's not perfect, you know, please take yourself to your local A&E if you are feeling suicidal or in immediate danger, because, you know, you are not alone. You know, as I've experienced many times before, and I'm sure gets said a lot, we feel so isolated when we're mentally unwell. But you are not alone, and people will want to help you.
Mm, they will. They certainly will. Rich, share with us how people can read some of your articles, because I think that they are exceptionally written. And as I've said throughout the show, they are very real and they are very raw, and you're very, well, you are radically honest through those. I know you write for Happyful magazine as well as other publications as well, but please share where they can access some of those.
Yeah, so, I mean, a couple of pieces are on Happyful. So if you head to Happyful online and you can search for my name, and my article should be there. I've also written for The Guardian and Telegraph. I think, again, by searching my name, probably with OCD next to it, and The Guardian or Telegraph, you'll find the pieces I've written. And if you're on social media, I'm on Twitter and Instagram. My handle is @richbiscuit21. Particularly if you're on Instagram, the link in my bio has about 7 other links to other stuff I've done as well. So, again, ironically, after watching the documentary last night, I have deleted Facebook from my phone. I've kept my account, but it's gone from my phone. I think my, you know, biggest tip at the minute right now, especially where we're spending so much time indoors, is for me, I have got rid of all notifications on my phone and stopped having the apps available on my home screen. So I have to go through like the app, all of the apps together. They're not in any folders or anything. And it's creating that friction between yourself and Facebook, and yourself and Instagram, and yourself and Twitter, or whatever you use. And try and find one hobby that doesn't involve your phone, that is either reading or knitting or writing or drawing or doing a puzzle or coloring or walking or, you know, talking with friends on the phone, not through social media, you know, actually picking up the phone and having a conversation mm-hmm. with people. Because I think those are the most meaningful conversations I have, and my writing is informed by real world conversations that I've had with people. So try and do that wherever you can, and also check your social media to see what I put out there.
Yeah. On limited basis though, maybe turn on the notifications just for your posts.
Yeah, maybe that's what you should do. No, stop them for everyone else and just click that little bell for me.
Well, I urge everybody to get on and read some of Rich's stuff, because it's really, really honest and very true, and it encourages. I think it doesn't beat around the bush, and it doesn't dance around some very important topics. some that we've not even covered today, but I'm sure, well, I would want, and hopefully Rich would come on and talk on another show about some other aspects as well. We said hopefully we'd get onto male suicide in a bit more depth as well, but maybe a show in the future, Rich, we could talk about that. I know you've written about it, so, but please get online in the respect of following Rich and reading some of his stuff as well. If I may share what I've taken from today's show, and I'll condense it as best as I can, but I think that it's easy for any of us to drift into a place that isn't particularly beneficial for us. So carrying a level of awareness, you said earlier about that there is a spectrum, and of course that sometimes the issue with our mental health and certainly mental illness, it becomes diluted, and there can be a shame sometimes if we are feeling the way we are, and so guilt and shame can play havoc on the way we think and the way we feel. Common misconceptions around OCD, and that OCD preys on the things that are so important to us and that we love. It devours and thrives on uncertainty. I think another big thing for me, what you said earlier, Rich, was the fact that it's reaching a point of acceptance and appreciation and recognizing that not all problems have a solution. Yeah. And I think that each and every one of us can take something from that. That I think sometimes society conditions us to believe that there has to be a solution to every problem. Sometimes there isn't, and perhaps more often than not. Radical honesty. Hey, look, there's an article right there for you. There's a book for you there, Radical Honesty. I think we'd all purchase that. Getting rid of notifications on our phone. Love that. And I don't suppose really we shouldn't really close the show without, or bid you farewell without, bringing your Nan's words of wisdom. A problem shared is a problem halved. And actually, you know what? I'm going to embrace this one going forward. Any time is cuddle time. Rich, it has been an absolute pleasure to share a conversation with you. And I just feel cheated that we have to finish it there, because it's just been brilliant to have you on.
Yeah, James, this has been fantastic. You know, I've been very fortunate to do a lot of things like this over the last sort of 10 years, and I always, you know, accept and acknowledge how fortunate I am, but conversations like this with people like yourselves are fascinating and educational and most of all hopeful. You know, I think that's the biggest thing is that I've been there where it's been hopeless, and I know how important it is to hear messages that are hopeful. So I hope that people take that away.
Well, I am sure they will, and I agree that I think that it is conversations such as this, and as we said at the top of the show, that we have to talk about it more. You know, yes, over the last 10 years there is more conversation, but it has to be meaningful conversation. It has to be conversation with purpose. It has to not be alienating conversation, and there mustn't be a division in what it is. And, you know, reaching out, speaking openly, honestly, radically, and each and every one of us, that if we are struggling, we just have to ask for help. We have to connect with those relationships or services that will bring us the value that we deserve.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Rich leaves us there. Rich, I nearly forgot. Before we close, we always end each conversation and hand it over to our resident expert to see what he felt of the show and what he thought at the time. So, Mr. Hanks, what did you think?
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
You're too kind. Uh, I agree that it was a successful broadcast. Rich leaves us there. You're still stuck with me till 3 p.m. before Ian Lee joins us for the Drive Time show. But I have been James Rose. My special guest today has been Rich Taylor. I wish Rich health and happiness going forward. And next week, we'll be joined by another great guest and more great music choices as well. Stick with us here on Phoenix FM.
Daisies swaying, free in the breeze. The birds in the trees are singing along with me. I'm just looking for happy. Sunrise lights my smiley face clock, sliding in my socks. I pour my first cup of tea. I'm just looking for happy. If you open your heart, you will see there's a million little opportunities to be looking for happy, looking for happy.
Pages where wizards and knights have magical fights as the rain taps so tepidly. I'm just looking for happy. In the sand, your head on my shoulder, drinking the moment the sun falls into the sea. I'm just looking for happy. Yeah, I'm just looking for happy.
Phoenix FM.